That's a leadership question. What kind of teams are we creating? You know, is it a team that's got trust, you know, at the top of it? You know, like I trust that my, in this case, senior NCO isn't trying to get out of something. He's trying to get healthy. But does the trust go the other way too? Like, does, in this case, does the NCO trust their leadership enough to be honest with them? You know, you have to have that bedrock laid out well ahead of time.
Greetings, Leg Talk Nation. Welcome back to another week here with Drew and Alex. Hopefully everybody had a happy Thanksgiving. I'm going to just go off on a limb here. Thanksgiving is the most overrated holiday on the calendar. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but
I'm going to firmly disagree, man. I love Thanksgiving.
Then name one other time where you go to the store and purchase a turkey.
The turkey doesn't make a ton of sense. I'll be honest. This Thanksgiving,
turkey
had
sucks.
Chicken. We had chicken. I'll be honest.
That's fine. I just think that, okay, let me back up. Turkey, Thanksgiving is a holiday in terms of family get-togethers is fine, but the food is overrated.
I mean, turkey itself might be overrated. I can respect turkey itself being overrated, but everything else is fantastic.
Name one.
Stuffing's awesome. Cranberry sauce is awesome.
But again, whenever.
Pie is fantastic. All of it's so good.
When do you ever have that during the year?
You don't, and I don't know why. We should have it more. I do. I'll randomly make Thanksgiving dinner because it's like good meal prep food. It holds really well. It's great.
You meal prep Thanksgiving food?
Not that hard. Yeah,
you don't do the whole thing. June.
Right? It works pretty well.
That is a serial killer move. If you showed up, if you showed up to the beach with turkey and cranberry,
why would I bring it to the beach? What are you talking about?
I don't know. Just something very far away from Thanksgiving would be a beach holiday. I digress. Yeah. Anyway, welcome back. Happy Thanksgiving. Who are we talking to today besides just the two of us?
We're talking to Nate Conkey.
Colonel Nate Conkey.
Correct. I should use the rank Colonel Nate Conkey. Anybody who was a cadet around the same time frame I was probably remembers him. But for the 99% of the rest of the audience, I will go through his bio quick here. Colonel Nate Conkey is a current United States Army War College fellow studying at Columbia University. Most recently served as regimental tactical officer for the 1st Regiment of United States Corps of Cadets at West Point. He commissioned as an infantry officer in 2000 after graduating from West Point with a bachelor's in aeronautical engineering, took a slight pivot and holds a master's in physical education from Columbia University's Teacher College. We'll talk a little bit about that career pivot he made. Colonel Conkey's infantry career has taken him from the 2nd Infantry Division at JBLM to the 101st at Fort Campbell, teaching at West Point's Department of Physical Education, 1st Cavalry Division at Fort Hood, and back to JBLM for multiple field grade assignments, and then a stint as the 1st Corps Commander's Liaison Officer to United States Army Pacific out in Fort Shafter, Hawaii. He returned to JBLM as Battalion Commander for 2357 Infantry of the 189th Infantry Brigade, and then most recently served as the Professor of Military Science for Auburn University's ROTC program in Auburn, Alabama.
War Eagle.
He's been selected as the next commandant of the United States Military Academy Prep School beginning summer 2024. Prepsters will appreciate that one. Colonel Conkey's deployments include as a rifle company commander to Kirkuk, Iraq, in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and as a future plans officer with 1st Cav to Bagram, Afghanistan, in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. His list of awards is pretty long, as you might expect, but I'll highlight a few: Bronze Star Medal, Purple Heart, Ranger, Airborne, Air Assault, Pathfinder, and both the Combat and Expert Infantryman's badges, as well as a little more uniquely, he was the Army's Athlete of the Year in 2014. We will certainly be talking about his rugby career a little bit in this episode. And he's married to fellow Colonel Kate Conkey, an Academy professor in the Department of Behavioral Sciences and Leadership. They have 3 kids together, and we will definitely also chat about the whole dual military family experience with 2 officers trying to pursue pretty intense careers as well.
And I think it's pretty safe to say that one of the main reasons we brought Nate on, Colonel Conkey on, is because he's legitimately a badass. You just went through his whole bio, but one of the other things we talk about as well is I believe he was a colonel when he did this. Maybe he will. Was a lieutenant colonel, but back-to-back 600s on the ACFT. And going into this recording, I think you and I were both of the impression that that was like within a week. And we asked him to clarify, and no, that was like legitimately back-to-back. So he is a card-carrying member of the elusive 1200 club. We challenged him to the even more elusive 1800 club, recognizing that really that could go on into the 2400s and beyond. For those of you out there that like a testy challenge, but no, as a colonel and as somebody who's been in for a while, some of the things that really stood out as being most impressive is that he's stayed relatively injury free, despite, like you mentioned, playing rugby, which is the greatest sport on earth, and also having a pretty illustrious infantry career. So we dive into a lot of that. I think there's a lot of cool lessons learned, a lot of practical lessons to be learned. But yeah, like I mentioned at the top, just pretty much a certified badass.
And I'll just highlight, going all the way back to like new cadet basic training, Morrow, experiencing that whole thing. Colonel Conkey was, or at the time, Major Conkey was just kind of like the pinnacle of fitness for what a lot of us saw. I don't know how many people had him as an instructor. He was my military movement instructor, jacked out of his mind and running ridiculously fast, leading run groups I was a part of where I was getting smoked and all that stuff. I heard from the rugby community, his nickname in that space is King Conkey, just a pretty dominant athlete all around. And as you'll hear in this conversation, just kind of a well-rounded human as well.
What is military movement? Because I just picture a class full of people like crawling and jumping over something.
There was a little bit of crawling involved. It's a gymnastics course every cadet has to take. It's a, there's like an obstacle course involved and a little bit of trampoline stuff. And
like, hey guys, we're going to crawl to lunch today.
Not quite that kind of military movement.
Oh man. Well, before we keep going down more rabbit holes, thanks for tuning in and enjoy. Hey guys, before we kick this episode off, just wanted to give a quick plug to the two options that we have for folks interested in training with us. We have the team-based Long and Strong program. And then if you are interested in a more engaging, intensive, more tailored option, we offer one-on-one coaching as well.
And you can find both of those on the training tab of our website, mopsandmos.com. And if it's the team training you're interested, click that link and you will find a one-week free trial.
So again, if any of the things that we talk about on this podcast are interesting to you as far as training goes, head to the website, like Alex just mentioned, select that training tab and follow the instructions from there. Enjoy the episode.
Did you finish your PhD? I know you were working on a PhD at Auburn.
So no, that's the other better Colonel Conkey was working on.
Okay.
Yeah. So that may have gotten, you know, up in the notes. No, that's what got me to Auburn though. And it's kind of funny. I've literally been on my wife's coattails our entire career, you know, dual military. I'm not kidding. Like she gets an assignment and then, you know, they kind of have to find a spot for me. And so, obviously West Point is the latest one, but Auburn was a perfect example. You know, she needed a spot to go get her PhD at so that she could come here to West Point to teach as permanent faculty. And that's where she wound up. And just perfect luck and timing. The professor of military science gig was opening up that same time. And so I got to go there for 2 years. And what an incredible experience. You know, obviously the culture and community of Auburn as a university, but the commitment that the cadets had to want to get better every single day, I don't think you could have recreated that in a factory. It was just an awesome experience for 2 years.
Since you brought it up, I kind of want to riff on this for a second because it's not something we've talked about, I think, ever on this podcast, but it's super relevant to like fitness and performance and things like that. But the whole dual military and managing family as you go through a career thing.
Right.
I think back a lot to when I was a platoon leader and I did not do a good job of factoring in like childcare timing and like when kids are in and out of school and how that affects everybody's life at home. Like that was not on my radar as I was like planning anything. And I kind of wish I had going back. So is there anything like, I know you wrote an article on it, we'll throw it in the show notes, but like dual military stuff that you would tell people about having to manage two careers at the same time and kids and all that stuff?
Yeah, great point. And question. And that article you referenced was written by my wife, and she slapped my name on it for
nice
S&G. But I think if you go back and look at that, it talked about communication and compromise. And that's the two things that I did not get very early on in our career. Fortunately, my wife was much more mature about it. And so she did and kind of tugged me along for the first part of it until I could kind of grasp what all of that meant. But yeah, no, early and often communication, obviously between the two dual military members. And then obviously that extends to the chain of command, you know, and being open and honest with what requirements there are, you know, certainly goes a long way. And then the compromise, again, you know, between you and your spouse, and then also the Army, you know, maybe one person is not going to be able to have the quintessential career and assignments and doing the exact things that they wanted to do, if they also value their marriage and relationship and the career of their spouse. Now one person can absolutely take the main effort role and the other person can just play the supporting effort. But what I really like about the way my wife and I have done it is we've been able to oscillate back and forth. You know, this year is the perfect example. You know, she is in a full-time job. She is the PL-300 course director. PL-300 is a core course for West Point cadets that you take as a junior, military leadership. So it's kind of important. And she's got a great team that she leads to instruct essentially the entire junior class, you know, 1,000 cadets, which puts me in the supporting effort, right? And that's easy. So whether it's picking up the kids from childcare or making dinner or doing whatever needs to get done, it's been fun.
So it's, you kind of already answered it, but like you guys both commanded battalions along that journey, yeah. Multiple deployments for both of you, I believe. Mm-hmm. I assume that means you ended up in the scenario a few times where one was deployed and one was not deployed. How'd you navigate that?
Yeah. So essentially three times there's been kind of like an offset. And again, I'll continue to come back to the Army has been so good to us. We are blessed, you know, we're lucky, whatever you want to call it. We've been really good. The first time was we were both in company command and didn't have kids yet. And so that kind of made it easy. You know, we worked with our chain of command. We knew we wanted to be deployed at the same time as opposed to doing like the tip to tail high five on the tarmac. I don't know how people do that. But I could see that the case for wanting to do that if there are kids, you know, for example, mm-hmm. You always have a parent that's home with them. But then the other two times, you know, I went away, you know, when our first child was a little young, and then number two was born. And then the last time, you know, as you mentioned, was when we were in battalion command. So my wife's command was overseas and mine was at JBLM. So I got to play battalion commander and single dad with some incredible, awesome help from all sorts of family, neighbors, friends that helped out from time to time. But no, we've been relatively lucky. There's some people that have had it a lot more strenuous, a lot more time intensive.
I just want to pause and reflect because I think this can officially count as our first fall episode. And Alex is in a beautiful cardigan. What tea are you drinking? You keep pulling up a tea.
Oh, it's we got the Good Earth, the sweet and spicy. If people know Good Earth, they'll know that because it's their classic one.
Not a sponsor. There are other tea companies out there. But
I'm writing this down then.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Good Earth, for sponsoring today's episode. But no, so one thing we did want to ask, and we talked about it, I think, a little bit before we hit record, but I'm not going to say you're old, but you've had over 20 years experience now in the infantry. And then for the folks that don't know, a smashing rugby career for probably equally as long, if not longer. So you cannot say genetics is the answer to this question, but I think to get this discussion going, how would you explain some of that? What are some of your key principles? What are some things that you would hang your hat on or doff your cap to, if you will, for the longevity piece of this?
Yeah, I think some things that you all talked about, you know, on this show, and that's, you know, the progression and periodization, you know, and knowing, you know, what you're working towards. You know, just recently was listening to your bit about the ACFT. You know, what is the test that you're working towards? You know, maybe it's a deployment, maybe it's your unit's medal. But for me, it was always wanting to be one of the most fit people, if not the most fit person in my organization, wanting to prove myself as a good role model to those coming up, wanting to compete for the all-Army team regularly and still try to do so. Part of it's a chip on my shoulder. We can get into as much of my back history if you guys want to play part therapist.
That's what the cardigan and the tea is for, from Alex. So.
Yeah. Good one. But, you know, I've been trying to prove to myself and probably not to others because nobody else cares, but that I can still do it and I'll still be able to do it. You know, I mentioned in that, you know, when they were first coming out with the ACFT and they were trying to come up with this test, you know, and by saying they, I mean, Dr. Chip East, you know, saying, hey, we're going to come up with this test where nobody's going to be able to max it. You know, I take that as a challenge and I want to be the person that makes that happen. No, we can't have a colonel playing on the All-Army rugby team. Like, I take that as a challenge. And nobody has said that ladder to me, you know, but it's just individual goals. I just want to continue wanting to strive for excellence.
I'm going to just lay this out here for people who like don't know you or don't have any experience with it, but correct me if I'm wrong. We talked about how you were the Auburn PMS for a while.
War Eagle.
And a little bit of background research popped up, some social media posts about you going out to cadet summer training. Multiple regiments are taking the test throughout the week. So you took the ACFT twice during the same week and maxed both of those. Is that correct?
This is where I usually be like, fake news, rumors, and trying to be humble. It is true. I did.
No, I did do that. Yeah, that was me. That was me.
They were back to back. They were the same morning.
So they were the same day.
Okay, that was my question. Same day.
Yeah, I finished one. I ate a banana and then I hopped in with the next group. It was great.
That's what I'm talking about.
We might make that part of long. That might be a long and strong.
But that came challenge. That came out from a challenge, right? So you know, once you accomplish a goal, is your new goal the same thing? No, it can't be. And so it just kind of came out kind of as a half-baked challenge from some of the cadre that were on our team at Auburn. And they said, hey, you, and actually it was another cadet. And again, the other thing too, right? Competition drives everything. So I had an amazing cadet, Andrew Sherrod. He's lieutenant out of Carson right now. Shout out. And he and I were battling to see who was going to get this 600 first. And we both met the goal same day. And so then we set to who's going to be able to get two of them back to back. And
the 1200.
But just the way it's set up at summer training, right? You know, like we think that leaders are supposed to inspire and motivate, you know, their subordinates. Well, it goes both ways. And when you're around, you know, this was one company taking the test. So there's probably 120, 150 ROTC cadets taking this test during any given day. Right, man, like the spotlight is on you. You know, you want to perform. And, you know, if me running around a track or pulling a sled is going to help motivate somebody else to do the same thing a little bit bigger, a little bit better, a little bit stronger, then heck yeah, I'm going to go for it. So it was just kind of a perfect confluence of events. It was a good day.
So I want to ask, because I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, because I think it's pretty clear that you value fitness as a leader. And I would agree with that. And I've seen a number of occasions just throughout my career where leaders who also happen to be fit and can sort of lead by example in a PT space tend to do well. The challenge there, I think, as we see some of these embedded performance teams, and not to make this conversation about that, but how does somebody in your position who is physically fit, physically capable of doing things like score the elusive 1200 on the AACFT, how do you balance that with not assuming that you need to take over from a subject matter expert who's coming into this position, maybe hasn't been around the military before, but still has a lot of value to add to the conversation around training and setting up training, if that makes sense?
I think it comes down to empowerment. You know, every team that I get to come be a part of, there's subject matter experts in every walk of life. And so I would welcome anybody with any kind of answers on that team to come up with something. And sure, maybe you get to a point where something's not working. And I mean, heck, the title of this podcast, Cast Mops and Mows, right? You know, like what performance outcomes are we getting? Are we having the effect that we need to? If not, okay, let's go back and talk about it. But if you have people in your organization, and I guarantee, you know, most people do, and you empower them, it leads to a sense of ownership, and that ownership then goes to performance. And it doesn't matter if it's physical, it doesn't matter if it's planning, I would welcome anybody as a part of our team certainly if they're there for that very reason. So if we had a high performance team, and I've never been in a unit that's had one, to be honest. I've longed for it. You know, I remember, you know, when I was in battalion command, we'd stare across longingly. I think it was 17th Fires, you know, was over there, and they had a bunch of folks embedded in their organization. I was like, oh, that'd be so great. But the alternative is me looking at, you know, captains that have, you know, master fitness training experience, or NCOs that have 10, 15 years under their belt of developing physical fitness plans, and saying, okay, guys, what do we got? And 9 times out of 10, they're coming up with quality products.
I can briefly insert something here.
Is this a shout out to your MFT days?
One of my students, when I was teaching MFT, yeah. was in your battalion at JBLM and spoke very highly of like getting sent over there because they wanted to get the opportunity to do it and stuff. So I can vouch for the fact that Colonel Conkey was not in the driver's seat for the PT program for the whole battalion. He was empowering NCOs.
Nice. thanks. Good shout out, Alex. I appreciate it.
Well, so as you're saying, I mean, I guess I sort of glossed over another question that I'm curious to ask you, which is that just your thoughts on, again, as a leader, the importance of the physical fitness piece. And you may not be the fittest person on your team or at your battalion, you know, company, whatever, but we've all seen leaders who I think maybe recognize that they're not that. And then instead of still being a motivating factor, they choose to just sort of like attack PT. They don't prioritize it. They don't recognize the importance of kind of leading from the front in that space. What are your thoughts on that?
I think we all naturally gravitate towards what the space that we're comfortable in. Right. Mm-hmm. And so for me in the physical fitness, you know, arena and, you know, actually some going back to Auburn and some of my cadets from Auburn probably wishing that I wasn't so comfortable in that space. Cause you know, there's been a couple times in my career, just as like a little side note, you know, you get a little bit of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know? And so I remember being an S3, you know, operations officer and an executive officer for my battalion. This is circa 2014. And my team would talk about me. And there was a garrison Major Conkey, which they apparently liked and approved of. But then the field Major Conkey, I think it's because there was high stress, you know, he did not approve of probably the way that he went about different things, to use the third person. And so it went at Auburn, right? So there was the version of, you know, then Lieutenant Colonel Conkey before 08 in the morning that they didn't really appreciate being around because I took a lot of things personally, you know, maybe effort not being the least of which. It's but to your point, it put out, you know, clear expectations, priorities. They understood what was important to me and therefore the organization. And we all got better because of it every single day. And that was powerful. And so to bring it back to what you were asking about, maybe other folks in that space that aren't that comfortable, you know, I would lean into it and or find the person that is good with it, right? So coming out of my role this past year as a regimental tactical officer at West Point, you know, maybe Excel spreadsheets and calendars aren't my jam. You know, I'm going to lean on somebody on the team that is good at that. And, you know, I had an amazing executive officer that took all that stuff off my plate. I don't need to worry about this. You know, maybe it's training a staff, or maybe it's, you know, find your subject matter expertise yourself, lean into that, but then also don't be afraid to go to others for help and assistance, and, you know, always be trying to fix the hole in your swing, so to speak.
So Drew asked about using a human performance staff. And I know you haven't been in a unit that had a dedicated staff, but before we kind of wrap up talking about some of the, like the Auburn leading cadets experience stuff, did you ever happen to engage with like strength and conditioning staff at Auburn? I know they have the Warrior Research Center there that's doing some pretty big things in the tactical space. Was ROTC tied in with them while you were there at all?
To some extent we were. They were great partners. The most of which we got was athletic training support, you know, and that was awesome, you know, and we really, what we were trying to do was mimic some of the support that we get here at West Point. And I say we here at West Point, because I'm physically at West Point. It's the assignment I just came out of. But having the, not necessarily on call, but the very readily access to some of that medical care, I think is not available, you know, probably in the Army writ large, other ROTC programs, and probably a lot of other spaces, you know, in our society. But the prehab I knew was key, because if we can get ahead of some of these injuries, you know, keep folks away from overuse type of injuries, we were going to do well. And that's what they helped us out a ton with. But Joel and Sefton was in charge of helping us out a ton. You know, we had Lieutenant Colonel Parks was finishing up his PhD. He's actually now here in DPE here at West Point as well. So yeah, it was a good setup of people all going to help us out.
And then the other one I was thinking about, you've mentioned like you were at West Point when working with Dr. East, and then when he was developing the ACFT and like taking that as a challenge and all that stuff. Do you, having
is
had
it,
like a pretty
is
extensive
it
career,
ACFT or ACFT?
I don't know whether, because I don't know which syllable the emphasis is on.
Right. Because we've had people say ACFT, we've had ACFT. I'm just curious as to what the actual true answer is.
See, now I'm primed. I wouldn't be able to come up with what I actually say now because I'm primed.
Because I ask, growing up in North Carolina, you go to, for those of you that are in this area, Carowinds is the theme park, and they had a ride called Top Gun, which is named after the movie Top Gun, but people would call it Top Gun instead of Top Gun, or Bojangles instead of Bojangles. And so I just ask, you know, out of curiosity. But anyway, continue with your questioning, Alex.
I think it's ACFT. That's why
there you go, ACFT or ACFT.
Emphasis on the fitness. I can take it. So, right. So my question is, given that you had, like, I don't know at this point, like what the split in your career is between APFT era fitness and ACFT era fitness, what have you seen is the impact, like, especially on folks who are new to the Army? Cause you were working with cadets who are new to the Army as a major under the APFT at West Point, and then you were working at cadets who are new to the Army as a PMS at ROTC. What have you seen in terms of like the change in the fitness culture with the new test?
I think it's better. That's the short version of the story. I think it still comes down to the tale as old as time, and it's the leadership and what they do to embrace it. You know, like, I know it's been a subject of this podcast and lots of other, you know, meme sites and everything else, but like the leg tuck, you know, and I'll just go ahead and start talking about it, right? You know, and you guys have talked about it, right? It's the bar that you set out there and said, hey guys, hey team, go get it. And instead of having leadership, I think, right, some leadership, and all these ideas were expressed as my own and not anybody else or any organization. You know, I think we had leaders that didn't embrace the challenge, and therefore that's contagious into the soldiers or cadets that you're leading. Therefore, that bar gets lowered instead of bringing your teammates along to get over that bar. We were the latter at Auburn and took great pride in the fact that there was this, at this time, like, new awesome test that we were all going to be challenged by together, and we were all going to get better together. And so from folks that, you know, would do horribly coming in, you know, yeah, they passed the minimum standards to join a program to get into RO. The ACFT was a little bit of a different animal. And so, hey, go from being, yeah, man, the pride that we could see in an individual's face when they go from doing zero leg tucks to six in a matter of 6 months, right? The test isn't too hard. We're not challenging people. So the ACFT is a better test. It's a better way to motivate people, but it still requires the leadership to help them get there, I think.
I'll throw one follow-up question on that. The running scoring scale is pretty different today than when the ACFT was first announced. Do you worry at all? I'm just going to say what I worry.
What was it originally?
I guess. Originally, maxing was something like 1230 or something like that. I don't remember what passing was because I wasn't paying too much attention to that. But it's shifted in a direction where we're like, we have people now who are like close to maxing the run at a pace that like would have failed them under the APFT. It's a pretty dramatic shift in the scale. And I wonder if you worry that the pendulum has shifted or swung too far towards strength and quote unquote anaerobic capacity, and we've left some of the aerobic potential behind.
Right. I have to believe, you know, I'm not in that room making those decisions. I have to believe that they're looking at data to try to normalize what it should be. And that's where I think that we, and I'll put myself in this group, like we as a leadership in the Army didn't challenge our folks hard enough early enough to give the Army good enough data to based off those shifts off of. So do I personally, as the athlete and more inclined to physical fitness, think that the standards are probably a little too low? Yes, I do. Are they more realistic according to the data? Probably, because that's what we've done as an Army is to move it there. But no, I mean, I'm the guy that had my APFT goals as a cadet on a sticky for all 4 years on my computer. You know, they said 82, 92, 1154. And I never made that goal. That wasn't 300. That was like a 375, I believe, at the time. But I never made that 1154, but it was always my goal. And that was the hardest part of the ACFT, when emphasis on C to get away from the P to differentiate.
something.
But that was the hard part was meeting that 1230. And it really made made us focus. And I go back to the cadet that I was challenging with, like, we had to go to our programming to make sure that we were doing the right things. And that, heck, we were rolling out in the middle of the test, you know, we had 5 minutes to get you, like, we're getting a quick, you know, elevation of our feet, you know, so really, really striving to try to meet that goal. And as it's gotten a little bit lower, I don't have to work as hard. Maybe that's not a good thing.
I mean, I guess a little bit of a generic follow on here, but given the transitions that you've seen with the testing specifically, but just kind of more broadly, the military as a whole, how have you seen the Army's culture of fitness change throughout your career?
We've gotten a lot smarter.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's been a lot more deliberate. Heck, even looking at units that, for example, don't do the 6:30 to 7:30, you know, maybe it's best for their organization to do PT in the afternoon. Like, you see that more than you ever have before. I remember the days of just running every single day and doing push-ups and sit-ups every single day. That's silly. What's that doing? Where, you know, I, as a lieutenant, you know, felt the need to, and certainly nothing against anybody wanting to do this now, but I would need to go get another workout in the afternoon because I hadn't been able to challenge myself earlier in the morning. But now the way that we can work different models, and you guys know this better than I do, but like, you can make it challenging for everybody, depending on what it is, you know, what components of fitness that you're working on any given day. But I think we've gotten a lot smarter, you know, like, not just throwing on a ruck and running for 6 miles, you know, in boots, you know, every other day. Like, that's not good for us. Those types of things, but mainly in the periodization and progression, I think we've gotten a lot better. We've gotten a lot smarter.
Do we think, I mean, this is more rhetorical than anything else, but as you're talking, I'm wondering, and Alex, maybe you have thoughts on this. Like, is that a bottom up change or a top down change largely? Because from my perspective, I see, I mean, and maybe it's because we sit here hosting our own podcast, but like, you do see this just surge on really social media, but like, a lot of conversation at sort of the ground level around, you know, reverse PT cycles and periodization and planning and blah, blah, blah. And some organizations just start doing it, and then policy follows and doctrine follows and that kind of thing. But like, has there been an example of a top-down change in that kind of thing?
I'll sneak in a comment and then let Colonel Conkey take it from there. And it's just the top two most frequent AAR comments we got when I was teaching Master Fitness Trainer. The first comment was, this course is awesome. Like, one of the best Army courses I've been to. Absolutely love it. Wish it was twice as long. Fantastic. And then the second most common comment was, my chain of command doesn't let me use anything I learned here. And so that was tough. And I'll tell you, I think...
Well, you still see that though, I think, in some places.
I think you do see it in some places. And it comes down to some of the leadership kind of thing Colonel Conkey was talking about before, with empowering NCOs and empowering junior leaders and things like that. But I think on a certain level, I think we've seen some senior leaders like take on the difference and change the way they're training and talk about it and lead in that direction. But I think a lot of where I've seen momentum building is lower on the chain of command. I don't know if that's true across the board, but.
So, you know, if leadership doesn't have the good idea sometimes, and I've certainly been guilty of this numerous times, like, sometimes you feel that it's a challenge, right? If it mm-hmm. comes from a subordinate element. But we, putting ego aside, you know, what's best for the organization. You know, I was coming in to battalion command, and myself and the sergeant major were coming both in at the same time, and you know, looking, doing a little bit of an observation of the unit beforehand. You know, we're looking at it, and you know, I'm like, sergeant major, we got to change this PT stuff because this dude is a PT stud. I mean, oh my gosh, sergeant major, we got to do something about this PT thing. We need to come in and fix it. And he was like that wise, you know, sage advice of any NCO that we as officers want to be paired with. He was like, hey, sir, let's come in, let's check it out. Because this was an organization that was doing PT in the afternoon, down at the lowest level possible, you know, whatever individuals needed, and, you know, at the lowest team level. And we came in, and the first thing I did, I hadn't done this in another organization before, but I was, you know, like, what's one thing you like? What's one thing you don't like? What's one thing that we're not doing that you would want to include? I must have gotten like to a man, or to a soldier, right? Like, probably 90% of the people were like, things we like was decentralized PT in the afternoon. And I was like, whoa, good thing I didn't mention that in the change of command speech. you just proof, like, listen to the NCO. I say all that to that. Yes, it is growing. I think to your point, it is a groundswell. It is probably a little bit more bottom up because us old people didn't grow up that way. But I think social media certainly helps, you know, like, hey, this unit, they're getting ready for, you know, they're going to reverse cycle ops, or they're trying to prep for, you know, going to NTC. It's going to be super hot, whatever it is. And so they do PT in the middle of the afternoon. Maybe that works.
So I'll ask, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I think that was a relatively unique battalion command, right? Like ACRC had active component, National Guard, Reserve, and the mission was to train Guard and Reserve for deployments, right?
Absolutely. So First Army has that mission of training our Reserve and National Guard partners. And I would not have been able to command a striker battalion. You know, we mentioned earlier, right? I was playing single dad, like had three kids at the house. So this special organization was almost built for me to be able to do this in this time and space. But yeah, had senior leaders of, you know, post company command captains and majors as the officers, had, you know, all the NCOs were prior platoon sergeants and or first sergeants. So very senior heavy organization. And our mission was to go out and work with our Reserve and National Guard partners, you know, up and down the West Coast. We're out of JBLM and over into Idaho and a little bit into Montana. But it was a great experience. And it was also, we didn't need, you know, I mentioned the example with me and the Sergeant Major, we didn't need to come in and, you know, beat the drum about the importance of physical fitness, right? It was, they knew it. They had that, you know, we talked about the empowerment and the ownership. They knew what their jobs were. We're often sending, you know, E7s out, you know, in pairs, you know, to the middle of California to go train up some infantry battalion. Like, you got to be able to trust those folks. And if you're going to trust them with that mission, you have to trust them that they know what they and their bodies need to keep themselves in good fighting shape.
So to follow up on that, I guess there are two questions. Because one, that's an organization where you might be able to get away with a little more decentralization. You can treat people with like a little more hands-off,
absolutely,
big boy, big girl rules. So first, I'm wondering like how that worked out. And did you run into any problems where it didn't work out in terms of personal accountability? But the second half of the question is, you're there to train Guard and Reserve soldiers. Did you see any significant difference in terms of fitness culture or fitness concerns with Reserve component soldiers preparing for deployments when it comes to fitness?
Yes. And not, you know, we as leaders, we're not supposed to walk by a standard because we now set a new lower standard. But I think with you know, our brothers and sisters that we were training, we weren't there to, if we're over the course of a weekend or maybe like a week long exercise, we're not there to instill a new warrior ethos and, you know, physical fitness goals. And most of them got it anyways, right? I mean, it's just the one-off kind of thing. You're not gonna be able to do or change, I don't think, in that case. It's really not worth, I don't think, the bandwidth at that point, right? As I'm partnering with battalion commanders and brigade commanders, you know, we're talking about like heavy level mission command and employing, you know, our combat forces, you know, what we're going to do to be the most effective. I'm not being like, hey, did you see Specialist Jones over there? You're like, we may want to check out the ABCP. Like, that's not part of it.
That's fair.
You know, and then internally, yeah, of course we had our challenges. You know, anytime you go decentralized, you know, there's folks that are going to push the envelope. And that's why we have the checks and processes in our system. And we do fitness tests and we do height weights and we hold ourselves accountable. So I think we did a decent job of doing that.
Fair enough. This next one is flipping the question Drew asked around a little bit. Not how has the Army's culture of fitness changed, but for you personally over the course of your career, how has your approach to fitness changed?
Oh, that's a good question.
No pressure.
Yeah. You know, it's probably, you know, having to work smarter and not harder. I remember chasing my fellow lieutenants, Neil Smiley, Phil Kinnery, Ben Williams, like up and down the block at then Fort Lewis.
Shout out fellow lieutenants.
Yeah, I love it. The mafia. But trying to keep up with them was intensive. And I probably wouldn't be able to do that to this day. I need to, you know, like, okay, maybe they're holding themselves to, you know, maybe they're a runner, or, you know, somebody else is a power lifter, or somebody else is a triathlete, or somebody else is, you know, specializes in this sport. But I was trying to be better than everybody at everything. And that's not really sustainable. And so I think have gotten to work smarter and know where my skill set is, you know, as an individual, and gotten to work, you know, towards, and like anybody, like any, in any sport, in any activity, you end up gravitating towards what you're good at. I think they call that the virtuous cycle, right? You know, you're good at something, you get better at it, which makes you want to do it more. You probably get some kind of affirmation. So you do it more, you get better at it, and you just go in that kind of circle. And so I still try to stay somewhat as a generalist and try to stay, you know, be able to kind of be in the ballpark of doing everything well, but have to be a little bit more strategic at it now.
Are you going to go for the elusive 1800 on the ACF team?
I don't know if that's in the cards. We'll see. We'll just focus on 600s for now, Drew.
That's fine. Someone told me that they didn't think you could, so I just wanted to throw that out there.
Writing it down right now.
For the record, no one said that, but you mentioned. But no, I mean, you know, we mentioned rugby a little bit earlier, but just along that journey, inevitably, you're going to face injuries, you're going to face setbacks, that type of stuff. What in that space have you dealt with, and what does that look like for you in terms of approaching rehab and approaching return to duty, but also in your own sport, kind of return to play?
Right. Good question. You know, and I think my answer dovetails into, you know, a previous question. I'm probably still only doing this because I didn't do it for years. So I actually came into rugby a little bit late. So I didn't play rugby at West Point or in college. I actually picked it up at probably about 25 years old. A funny aside, my XO at the time, who did play rugby in college, but I'm an HHC company commander, this XO, he's like, "Yo, sir, you may want to come out to rugby practice because you need a way to get some aggression out." So that was my introduction to rugby. Thank you, Preston Robinson. So I didn't start playing until a little bit later in life. And then it wasn't the intense collegiate athletic experience where you're going hard 5 or 6 days a week. It was maybe a couple runs throughout the week, get a game in. And then certainly as I've gotten older, I haven't played nearly as much, almost not at all during the year, you know, stay in good relative fitness, and then surge, you know, before the summertime, you know, the All-Army team, we play in August, the Armed Forces Championship. And so just surging at that time of year, I'm able to get ready. So from a rugby perspective, I think that's why I've been able to do that. And I think I dodged the initial question.
What kind of injuries have you experienced through that? And not specific just to rugby, but just as somebody who's been as active as you have for so long, I think, and Alex mentioned this at the top, like one of the things you hear all the time, especially from senior leaders, and this is not a knock on them, but like, the injuries pile up and that becomes somewhat of a, I don't want to use the word excuse, but a little bit of a crutch, you know, hey, I got to do this version of the ACFT, or I'm only doing three of the events, that kind of thing. So what does that look like for you?
It's a little bit of luck and timing. So, you know, I've got my five jumps out of airborne school, a couple more at Ranger school, but I've never been in an airborne organization. Right. So that's a heavy toll. I think I realized early on, you know, there was a couple of ruck run competitions that we did, but maybe I didn't really like the feeling in my knees too much. So I probably stopped the ruck running portion of what we were doing at my personal program. And then that usually cascaded into any organization that I was in charge of. So there's, from that perspective, I haven't had to kind of endure those types of injuries. I've been in organizations where if I did get hurt, it was along that same empowerment, ownership, and performance kind of pathway. Like if I was hurt, I just got fixed. I was never pressured to like, keep going, keep going, keep going. You know, your team needs you or anything. Like it's like, get healthy and get better. Haven't had any, you know, knock on wood, serious injuries. Probably the most serious thing I did have was a knock on my head, and that was a concussion. Probably several others that weren't diagnosed, but you know, one playing rugby that was pretty serious. You know, you get blown up a time or two, and that I'm sure weighs on you. But nothing that really takes you or that took me out of the fight or had long lasting impact. So extremely lucky and blessed actually.
So this is probably the most cliche question I've asked on the podcast, but I'm going to do it because we've talked about rugby a number of times now. How has that sporting environment given you or has it given you a perspective on leadership that you think you wouldn't have had otherwise?
I think we learned so much from team sports that can't even come close to being explained, you know, and it comes down to places like here at West Point. You know, we were quoting DPE earlier, every cadet an athlete. But if you look at a couple things, like the discipline and work ethic that you have to have, and this is across, you know, many more sports other than rugby, but the discipline and work ethic, like the training schedules that you have to put yourself in. And this isn't me I'm talking about. Like I'm envisioning the 60-man roster from the West Point rugby team and why I hold them on just such a high pedestal. But I think that's the first thing, discipline and work ethic. The second one is kind of the teamwork and collaboration. Rugby, I think, is unique in that anybody can be in charge at any time if they've got the ball, and everybody's got to be in synchronization with one another to be able to do it effectively. And, you know, it teaches you team skills. You know, I rode here at the academy. I was on the crew team for 4 years, and yeah, you've got to be in sync there, but generally you've got a metronome to what you're doing and you know what's coming. But in rugby and, you know, a lot of other contact sports, you know, one cut left or cut right and the whole game plan changes. And so you got to be in sync with each other. And then the third thing is probably the resiliency, adaptability, you know, like that grit factor. And when you come up against challenges, setbacks, failures, defeats, whatever, like how do you react to it? So, you know, here on the West Point rugby team, you know, Coach Sherman, you know, he talks about the climb all the time and how we're getting better. And yes, we may be going up and take a quick dip, and maybe whether it comes in terms of an injury or a loss or something, individual play that doesn't go our way. It's how we bounce back. You know, boxers say, like, how fast do you get up off the mat and then start swinging again? How do you get yourself up off the floor? So, no, I think rugby teaches us so much, you know, and that's not, you know, I left out the whole, you know, like, you know, winning matters, you know, and, you know, it being a people first, you know, business. But that direct parallel from rugby, from team sport to leadership, to the Army, I don't think can be understated. I could talk about this for hours. Sorry.
Well, hold on. I'm gonna steal Alex's riff and riff ahead of him, because I have a follow-on riff to my riff about rugby. You talked about team sport, and we've heard this a number of times from a number of different people, and it's almost a cliche at this point, you know, the values you get from team sport, et cetera. How do you think you can instill some of that into a military culture that also harps on the team, that also harps on a lot of the things that you have just listed there from a field sport perspective? But it just seems like there's just something missing, if I can go so far as to say that.
Hot take, more team sports.
Yeah.
You know, oh, the injuries are going to go up. Oh, well, let's get some prehab in. Like, if I know I'm going to be doing a sport or an activity that's going to involve some type of agilities, let's train up for it. Let's do some agility drills so I don't have Achilles and ACLs lying around all over the place. But, you know, I didn't even mention it, you know, as I was kind of going off on rugby and the benefits, but the esprit de corps and the cohesion, that, like, that's huge. And I think when you have, and it doesn't have to be team sports, right? But, you know, anytime you take a small team, an organization, a unit, and you place them in a tough spot, and it could be, you know, bottom of the ninth inning, or it could be, you know, a couple minutes left and you need to try, or it could be, hey, we're on the side of a mountain and we need to figure out how to get up and over to get to our LZ, our extraction point. You put them in that crucible type of event and you're going to grow together as a team. And I think that's where we can do wonders. And, you know, I'm, you know, taking all these courses and going to Columbia right now, organizational psychology, group dynamics, you know, it comes down to the teamwork that you're generating. So it could be out in business. It could be out in industry, right? Like, you know, the leader that's at the front of that formation, what are they doing to build that team? I think you can learn it a lot of different ways. Team sports certainly helps. Crucible events certainly helps, but you know, being a good person, right? You know, I'm always holding myself up to that that challenge. But you know, the motivating factor, trying to get people all going in one direction, you know, the vision, direction, motivation. I'm going to start going off on my leadership philosophy here in a second.
It's interesting though, because, and not necessarily a question, more a thought, but you know, we mentioned Dr. East as somebody who we all mutually know. And if you look at the physical culture stuff specific to the military, you know, and I've got a physical fitness manual from 1914 on my desk. Like, team sport is a huge component of that. Like, they block out time in the schedule each day for team sport. And I think, to your point, like, man, could you imagine a modern day military, not even just the Army, but just a contemporary military organization having that as a priority, what that could do to potentially solve a lot of the problems that we see come up all the time now.
Yeah. And a lot of them are based off of, you know, not having, I think some of the problems are based off of not having cohesive teams, right? You know, can you handle problems at the lowest level possible, you know, before it explodes into something? Probably more likely to do if you're familiar with a culture where, you know, individuals are empowered. You feel like everybody has a say. Not everybody's in charge, everybody's in command, but, you know, you feel comfortable. You have that, it's a safe place, right? You know, and, where, you know, the private or the specialist can raise their hand and be like, hey boss, I don't know if this is the right thing. You're more likely to see that. And I think in a locker room, so to speak, you know, somebody's out of position, you know, that's another thing, right? You know, what do we call things in the military and the Army? You know, if you walk by it, you need to make a correction, right? You're like, I need to fix that, but I need to make a correction. What is it when you're playing sports? It's not like, I'm going to make a correction on my fly half who's not in the right spot. No, you give them feedback. Mm-hmm. That's what it is, right? And so, you know, probably a little bit to Dr. East's point as well, right? The mindset and how we approach things. Like, let's not go around correcting people. Like, let's provide feedback to them, because I think most of us are more receptive to feedback. You know, it's not that I have to do PT every morning. I get to do PT every morning. Like, simple things and shifts in our mindset, I think, can go wonders. Or do wonders for us as individual units, teams, and maybe even as a force.
So I've thought of like five different directions we can go with this. This is not going to end.
I apologize.
So this is not going to end in a question. I'm just going to like ramble a bunch of statements and then like let you take it from there, I guess.
Classic Alex.
You made me think of a bunch of different stuff. One that I don't necessarily need to reply to that I've been thinking about is, you mentioned all the like the every cadet and athlete team sport kind of environment stuff, is I think more Army leaders could probably benefit from leadership in an environment where people are there because they want to be there, right? Like there was a lot of leadership experience I got at West Point, but I think the most valuable was when I was working with the climbing club and sitting down with Sue Kligerman and trying to like figure out the direction of the club and stuff. And that's because we had to create an environment that people chose to be a part of and then chose to stay a part of, rather than a military environment where they're kind of forced to be there.
You got to create an environment.
Absolutely. 100%.
Words mean things, Alex.
And I still like, of the people I work with at West Point, I still talk to her all the time because of that experience. And like what we, it's just super cool stuff. But I kind of want to pivot towards an injury conversation here, because you mentioned some things that I think are valuable. Big picture, we talk about injury prevention a lot in like the H2F space and the military tactical human performance space and things like that. And I think there's a little bit of a problem in like how that's interpreted, because the ultimate injury prevention is to just remove all risk.
Yeah,
like put people like maybe on stationary bikes and not even that much stationary biking, because eventually you might get some tendonitis or something like that. Like the only zero injury environment is a no activity environment, and that's going to give you much, much bigger problems. So how do we redefine it in terms of like early identification of injuries? How do you address it? How do you respond to it? How do you work through rehab better? Because you mentioned being in units where you didn't have like the helicopter leadership kind of like pushing you to endure through an injury. You were able to address it. And I've heard that story too many times. The number of senior NCOs I've talked to who knew they had plantar fasciitis but never got any treatment or never recovered from it, and it got to the point where they needed a fasciotomy. And for those who don't know, like getting a fasciotomy on your feet, like that can be a career ending kind of thing. Like you're going to be pretty limited after that. And I think listeners from this podcast who are in the military, probably many of them have stories of an injury that they could have had addressed early when it was something minor, and instead let it become something that might limit them permanently. And I think that there's just a conversation there about, it's not really about preventing injuries. It's about how do we respond, because injuries are inevitable to a certain degree.
Right. I don't think that's a technical question, you know, in the sense of like, what kind of risk are you willing to take, or you know, how are you going to put that type of program into your organizations or units? Like, that's a leadership question. What kind of teams are we creating? You know, is it a team that's got trust, you know, at the top of it? You know, like I trust that my, in this case, senior NCO isn't trying to get out of something. He's trying to get healthy. But does the trust go the other way too? Like, does, in this case, does the NCO trust their leadership enough to be honest with them. You know, you have to have that bedrock laid out well ahead of time before this individual case comes up. You know, the care that you have for each other, you know, as individuals and the organization is important. You know, that, like we talked about earlier with the dual military bit, but communication is huge. We all have this collective responsibility to make sure that we as an organization are ready. And so, again, if it's a lot of climb and then just a little bit of dip to be able to get more readiness in the future, that's probably what we all need to be having our arms wrapped around. But it starts early and often, obviously at the top of whatever organization you're talking about.
That resonates well with me. I've ended up in a lot of conversations through the Instagram page about profiles and how to navigate that whole thing. You've been in long enough. Like the AR-40-502 has changed during your career in terms of like access to profiles, right? Yeah. Profiles are, and this is just going to be like speaking straight to the Army audience.
I was going to say, you may want to define what a profile is.
Yeah.
It's not Facebook.
What that regulation is, because holy smokes, you must be looking right at that.
Dude, he just reads regulations like for fun.
There's, again, I don't read all of the regulations. I read regulations that are relevant to fitness.
For fun.
So AR-40-502 is the Army's medical readiness policy. And it has changed in some pretty significant ways that leaders are probably familiar with. Profiles used to be kind of a recommendation. Commanders could just choose to do something different. That's not the case anymore. Commanders retain the ability to make deployability determinations, but the profile is not a recommendation. That's separate from deployability. And like profiles have HIPAA considerations and things like that. So like in a lot of Army units, there's an expectation that like if you have a profile, you have to have it on you, or else your leader is just going to ignore that the profile exists because you don't have a physical copy on you. Again, not a real thing, but it all comes back to what you talked about with trust, right? If you're relying on that piece of paper and the specific notes in the paragraph from the provider about what to do to make decisions about that soldier's performance, you've probably skipped over establishing the environment of trust where like a squad leader can have a conversation with a soldier about, okay, you can't do X, Y, and Z. Let's figure out what you can do and figure out some good training where you can get after it. Instead, you're getting in like an administrative fight about what the piece of paper says you can't do. And I think you're missing the point when you get to that. I don't know. I've had lots of conversations with this about a lot of leaders. I'm not sure we know what the answer is, but.
I think you stated it very well. I'm going to come back. It sounds so simple, right? You're like, you know, I could be sitting on a therapist chair and you're, what are they going to, you know, like, how do you help your family or your married life? Communication, right? You're like, but that's the answer here too, is having early and honest, frank conversations with up and down the chain of command, and then also with the provider, right? So the best spots that I've been is when leaders talk to those care providers along with the soldier, not in a hovering mode, but just a good, honest dialogue to make sure that we're not going to hurt the soldier. That's what we don't want to do. We need them. We need a fully functional, ready force.
Seems reasonable. Harder, easier said than done. But I do want to ask you, we are approaching the hour mark here. I want to respect your time. I have one last kind of oddball question, and I think Drew's got some closers for us. But your bachelor's degree is in aeronautical engineering, correct?
Fact.
All right. And then your master's degree is in physical education.
Yes, they're the opposite side of the spectrum, if that's what you got me pegged as.
Can you walk us through the decisions or the changes in your like life plan and interests that led you from aeronautical engineering to physical education? And then as an add-on to that, which one do you think you'll use after you retire from active duty?
Great questions. And it's one that I talk with cadets about all the time. And I think I would have followed my own advice, and that was I followed my passion. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much been my MO my entire career. I've been pretty blessed that it's worked out. But as a cadet, I go back to like I was 7 or 8 years old. I got my head craned up at the sky anytime a plane or a helicopter goes by, and I was just absolutely amazed by flight. And I was that kid that, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I wanted to be an astronaut. I kind of got, you know, sucked into the awesomeness of junior ROTC for a year in high school, and I made me realize that I probably needed to get good grades if I was going to do anything like be an astronaut or go to college. And oh, by the way, there's this place called West Point that you might be interested in. And so that grabbed my attention. But when I got to West Point, you know, I still was amazed by things that flew. And we had an aeronautical engineering program, a mech, but with an aero track. And that's what I wanted to do. It probably helped that there was a couple other folks close to me in my cadet companies that were interested in the same thing, like a good kind of peer pressure. I had some amazing project partners that helped me get through that major as well. So it certainly wasn't all me, but I also still at the time, you know, was considering being an astronaut, and that aeronautical engineering into being an aviation officer was a track that I was looking at heavily. However, I got to my junior year, my Cal year, what we call it here. And there were essentially tryouts to go to a summer training where you wouldn't just go to a regular unit to tag along for the summer and help lead a formation, but you could go to a Ranger battalion. And so PT scores, I'm sure, were at the heart of it. And you placed the challenge in front of me, and heck, that's what I want to go do. And so I went and did this, what we call CTLT, Cadet Troop Leader Time, experience with 275. And it absolutely changed my outlook and my vision on what I wanted to do in the Army. And so now getting back to 275 was my goal as an infantry officer. I also foolishly thought that every infantry platoon would be like a Ranger platoon, and that wasn't quite true. But no, certainly no regrets. And I got out into the force as an infantry officer, and that's what I've been doing ever since. The PE portion comes into another goal, and that's when I left West Point. I wanted to come back to the Department of Physical Education, right? You know, from, you know, just a very myopic standpoint, like who wouldn't want to work in a $100 million facility wearing shorts and t-shirt, just yelling at cadets. No, we don't yell. Correcting, providing feedback.
There you go.
Cadets,
there you go.
on a daily basis. And so that's what we set our sight on. And so again, using my wife in her coattails, she got picked up to teach in the behavioral sciences and leadership department first. And then, I got to go over to DPE, but that entailed going to get a phys ed degree. So very long explanation to those two sides of the spectrum, but which do I use on a regular basis? Obviously it's the phys ed degree. And more importantly, it was all the conversations that I had in the 3 years working around some just insanely gifted staff and faculty surrounding me in that building, that still shaped my programming, you know, what I try to do personally, any other units or organizations that I'm a part of, are from that time. So obviously continuing to use my phys ed background.
Well, if you still want to be an astronaut, we just wrapped up our NASA series, so we'd be more than happy to connect you with anyone over there.
I need to go back and check that out. I don't know if I have enough time before my MRD, but we'll try.
Yeah. I mean, anything is possible.
I challenge you to get on the astronaut program.
Yeah. Someone told me that they didn't think that you could do it. So, you know,
I'll write that down right underneath 1800. So,
If it makes you feel better, I have a minor in African studies and my master's degree is in exercise phys. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah. I heard you say that. That's well done.
All right. So the closing questions I like to ask senior leaders, and there's two of them, and these can be quick answers. These can be long answers, totally up to you, but I'll give you a 5-year timeline. It doesn't have to be, it can be 3, 5, 10, whatever, but just something you've changed your mind about in the last 5 years as it pertains to leadership.
That is a good one. I don't know if it's in the last 5 years I changed my mind on this, but at some point I realized it wasn't about the me, it was about the we. And you're like, no kidding. You're leading teams. That's what it's always been about. But I think as a younger officer, I was, and some would probably still say this, but was much more immature, hadn't been around the block, even half the block yet. And so at some way, shape or form, I realized it, the words we, us, and our are the most powerful words you can use as a leader. Remove I, remove me, remove my, to as much extent as possible. I probably slipped up several times as we're talking here today, so please don't go run the tape.
We can edit it. We can.
Yeah. deep fake. But I think that's powerful, and that creates this sense of, I mentioned earlier, the collective responsibility. When others in your formation hear that it's always about the organization, it's about the team, it's palpable, it's contagious, it's infectious in the good kind of way. And the only time you use those words, I or me or my, is when something bad probably happens, where you need to take responsibility and own it. But it took me a long time to figure that out. So whether it was in the last 5 years or not, I don't know. but I'll go with that one.
All right, second one then. What is something, and again, 5 years, 3 years, 10 years, whatever, what's something you've doubled down on?
Physical fitness.
Doctor.
Yeah, good figure. know what your strengths and play to them. I'm not going to walk into a meeting or to a room, an auditorium, and try to pretend like I'm the smartest one in the room. I don't care if like I'm a colonel and it's all, you know, fill in the blank rank. I'm humbled every single day where I'm around other people, whether it's in our Army formations, you know, just finishing up as an RTO. So working with captains and majors, post command captain, like these folks are doing things that I would have never sniffed at as, you know, a junior officer, let alone even now. Same with cadets, right? You know, and I know there'll be a lot of folks listening to this that, you know, either on the ROTC side or the West Point side, like no way, shape or form did I ever dream of doing the things that cadets do to these, excuse me, that are doing these days with the demands on their time and the resources. We ask a lot of them and they do it awesomely. To think that I've got all the answers, absolutely not. But to get back to the PT point, that probably is one of the areas of strength, you know, and I get it from hanging around with 20-year-olds all day, all, you know, every day for the last, you know, probably 3 or 4 years. And that's kind of been in my head, you know, like not that I am 20 years old, I know that, but I need to be able to run with them literally and figuratively. I got to keep up with them. And so playing to the strength of physical fitness, hey, this is something I'm good at, I'm much more of a strong ranger than I am a smart ranger. Let's double down. We'll emphasize the importance of this and knowing my strengths.
Cool. Well,
awesome.
I can't think of a better way to wrap it up. So thank you for your time. And then also thank you for your perspective. This has been a really fun one.
Oh, this has been an awesome opportunity for me. While I cringe at the thought of listening to myself on tape, I do look forward to going back and listen to some old episodes you guys have and then anything in the future. So thank you again.
Of course.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.